Welcome to Radio Naturopath, a talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, May 28th on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days after recording, and also on my YouTube channel anytime at Radio Naturopath. And Ron Meniza is sitting right here with me. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. If you're listening to the show on WHUS, happy heavenly birthday, Daddy. His birthday was May 28th, and he left this world on December 13th, 2016, which was the 14th of Kislev. Losing a parent is very sad, and I miss him, and I think about him every day. Do you miss my dad?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a good guy, and he was an opportunity for Ron to have a dad, because Ron lost his dad when he was in his 20s. My dad was a complicated man, but in the end, I had a good relationship with him. But I miss him all the time. I have a picture of him on my bookshelf in my office, so I get to see his picture every single day. And I miss him, so you probably can relate to that when you're missing a parent. Thank God my mother is still with us, and happily, my family is down visiting her in Florida, and I'll be visiting her in a couple of weeks, which will be very nice. I wish she lived further north, but she's happy down there, so what are you going to do? And it means that I get to go to Florida a few times a year. That's all right. So, I'm feeling pretty good. I've been riding my bike. I rode my bike outdoors a couple times. I have not been getting in a lot of outdoor bike rides this spring so far because the weather has not lined up with days off or travel plans. And so I've been doing a lot of indoor riding on my trainer, which actually helped because when I had a very nice ride on Saturday where I felt strong and I felt good. And we did okay, and I rode outside yesterday, today, because I like to get my riding done before making the show, and it's early. It's still at a point where it's very cold in the morning. Like, if I waited till the afternoon when I'm tired after making the show, I wouldn't want to ride. So I rode indoors this morning, and it was okay. But things are pretty good, knock on wood. My knees are not too bad at the moment, and my knees actually feel better after riding this weekend, which is amazing. I did have some good acupuncture on Friday, and I'm continuing to get regular chiropractic, and no tremors, no shakes. So we're doing okay, knock on wood. The only thing is intermittent extreme fatigue. Today is not an intermittent extreme fatigue day. I'm very happy about that. I woke up feeling pretty good. And unfortunately, I'm realizing that my sleep is interrupted by this guy in my bed. So poor guy in my bed.
Anybody I know?
Yeah. So this poor guy in my bed. So what's up with you?
Oh, I've got, you know, issues, of course.
Yeah.
But we're getting closer. We're getting closer.
I'm getting closer to
my
home.
So I got a little interruption on my spinal cord from my C2 down to my T1, which is basically your neck.
The brachial plexus.
Right.
Yes, it's the nerve complex that comes from the neck and goes all the way down your arms, but also, unfortunately, your spinal cord, you know, everything, your spinal cord, you need your spinal cord to not be interrupted all the way down. It's like if you have, you know, the power company and there's an interruption from between the power company and your house, or a slight interruption, you're not going to get as much power at your house, no matter how far your house is away.
It's so, like if you have a garden hose and you pinch it.
And you have a kink in it, right?
Right,
so
exactly.
you're going to get okay function above the pinch, but not so much beyond it. And his pinch is way up north. It's like,
I'm not getting okay function anymore.
No.
I'm getting moderate to light function.
Right, that's just why you have
that's
weakness and everything.
That's probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
So I went to a neurosurgeon who pointed out to me as we were looking at my MRI, which he had transformed over into a three-dimensional thing. It was kind of cool. He kind of spun it all around and he showed me from every angle what was going on, and he said, what's going on here is really serious. He said, it's not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. And he was actually very surprised at the effect that I was having, that there wasn't a lot of pain involved.
Yeah.
Because he said
pain, though.
Most people, well, I do, but not, I guess not at the level of other patients that he's had come see him.
I see.
And I have a question as to whether or not some people get a little dramatic about their pain.
No, some you can't judge. You cannot judge. Nociception does not necessarily correlate with the physiological presentation.
Right. Because I am in pain, but you know, I've been in pain before.
You also have a high pain tolerance. You've trained yourself to have a high pain tolerance.
Maybe.
Part of the experience of pain is psychological. And so people can train themselves to feel like pain is not so bad. I mean, it's very, very rare that I take pain medicine. You know, if I have a pain in my knee, I don't take medicine unless it's intolerable. And it's very rare that it's intolerable. I use pain because I want to use pain as a guideline for what's going on in my body. But again, you know, people have varying experiences of pain. If you're very stressed, you're probably going to feel pain worse than someone who works on their stress. And I'm someone who works on my stress all the time. I mean, I definitely have stress. But when I'm pretty good at, like, when I get away from the office, I have ways to calm down, and I work on it. And I find the longer I do a restorative yoga class, the better I feel. So if I can get that 45-minute restorative yoga class versus a 20-minute yin, I feel better afterwards, and it calms my nervous system down. So you and I are pretty good at, you know, we'll work through pain, which isn't always necessarily the best thing, and we also do things to calm our nervous systems down.
Right. And pain is the way of your body telling you that something is terribly wrong. And
yes,
that, you know, maybe you shouldn't do that. It's kind of one of those things.
Right.
But in this case, I don't have real high levels of pain. I have high levels of fatigue.
Yes.
And so the fatigue is really the major problem that I've been experiencing. And he looked at it and he said, well, no wonder. He said, you have no flow, no nerve flow going
right.
to your lower body. Everything.
Right.
So that's why my muscles are weak from my shoulders, my arms, my hands, my legs.
Right.
Everything is just like really interrupted.
Right.
So there are suggestions, and I'm putting in I have already put in a call to a possible second opinion here, which I'm looking for. Through my cardiologist, because he is very interested and concerned with what's going on with me, which is kind of, you know, he's taken a real interest to it, which is kind of cool.
Well, it's great to have a team.
Right, exactly. And so there is a team where he works out of, I should say. He doesn't operate, he just works as a cardiologist there. But there's a really good team there, too. And so, you know, I'm just kind of weighing out my options right now. But what has been introduced to me after looking at all of this is a laminoplasty.
Right.
And the laminoplasty is basically they're going to cut the back of the vertebrae bone, and they are going to put another cut on the other side, but it's only partially, and it's kind of like a wedge shape.
Yeah.
And they're going to pull it out, let the wedge fusion together, and they're going to put a plate in.
Yeah.
And that's what a laminoplasty is. What it does is it opens up all of the backside of your spinal column. So
there's more space, because now you have actual pressure on your spinal column.
I have no space anymore.
Yeah.
There is
you have actual pressure,
to no
yeah.
space. And
yeah.
Again, he was pretty amazed that I was functioning the way I was functioning, considering how severe it is. Because
yeah.
he said it's very severe.
Well, you're clearly still getting some nerve flow.
I'm getting something.
Of course you are.
I'm still walking.
You're still walking. You're still, not only walking, you're like moving wood around and teaching spin class. And
right. But he did stress the immediacy of the issue, because he said it will not get better. And it will only get worse. And And he said he was, you know, very impressed with my physical condition because he thinks that this surgery could go very, very good.
Right. And so as long as you don't have...
I'm recovered.
As long as you don't have extreme nerve damage, then you should get your function back. Let's hope you don't have nerve damage. But the other side of having nerve damage is it is possible to have neuroplasticity. That is, you're going to build... Remember how your heart, the reason that you that they were so impressed with you with your cardiovascular situation was because all of the cycling that you did, you created corollary arterial circulation to make up for the fact that you had all those blocked coronary arteries.
Right.
Well, you have neuroplasticity as well. Even at your age, your very ancient age.
I'm not that old.
Neuroplasticity is still a thing. Do you know why they tell you to make the 39 with X number of years of...
It'll be 31 on Saturday.
Yes, I know. 31 years of experience. Do the math. Anyway, you know why they keep telling you to do those fun games that you like to play, especially the word games, because at any age you can still create new nerve connections. So you're still going to be able to do that. So if there's some nerve weakness, you probably can get some nerve function back. And I can give you stuff to hasten that.
Yeah, well, let's see where I land first.
One of the things you have to take is fish oil. Fish oil.
I take fish oil every day.
Yes. And we'll probably also give you phosphatidylserine. I have to just look at what you're taking and we could, you know, change some things up.
Okay.
But you, you know, you might do very well for this. So... anyway, shout out to Karen, my old roomie from Portland, Oregon. She's listening. Anyway, so I'm psyched. I'm looking forward. Obviously when he goes under the knife, which he's done twice since I've been with him, Thrillsville. I get
it. Not about you.
Yeah, but I know, but it freaks me out. You know, it's scary. It's like you worry and stuff.
Yeah.
So I need to know when he's going to actually go under the knife, so I can drive him there and stay in the hospital and worry and sit and worry with Susan.
I have to have another consult before I can make that decision.
So I wish you would do it already.
I can only operate as fast as they operate. I just got this information on Friday.
Right.
And guess what? Yeah. People actually took the weekend off.
Oh, yeah, because it was Easter weekend. Yeah, I know.
And now it's Monday, and I put a second call in
right.
to a different avenue of recommendation.
So the wheels turn.
It's not me that's going slow here. Okay?
The wheels on the bus go round and round.
I'm on top of this. Because the last thing I want to do is deal with this another day. I am really tired of it.
Yeah, no kidding. I feel bad for you.
In so many ways.
I just miss riding bikes with you.
I can't really ride my bike.
I also like to sleep.
Yeah.
And he has restless nights, and sometimes he has restless nights, and it makes it harder for me to sleep. And I wake up in the morning going, I'm so tired, and it's... actually because he was kicking me all night.
Probably my fault.
Yeah,
of course.
So I don't know, last night I slept pretty well. You must have slept okay, or you managed to not upset me, because I slept really well last night for a change and woke up pretty good. I think that sitting in front of a computer, the focus required to do my practice, and also sitting in front of the computer screen takes a lot out of me. The hours and hours of screen is hard on me. I like to pull some stuff out of the news. Single food studies. So single food studies, it's an interesting idea. And so, you know, there's some headline that says that there's research that says that if you eat this food, it reduces your risk of this disease. So there's single food studies. So you feel like every day you have to eat an apple a day. So if you look at, if you do 2 cups of mango a day, for example, it can reduce insulin resistance. So who's going to, you know, focus on eating 2 cups of mango a day? That seems like kind of ridiculous. So, I mean, unless you live somewhere where you get wonderful fresh mangoes off the tree. And, you know, the writer went to Vietnam where she got local fresh mango. But Finding and eating that fresh fruit with natural sugar and fiber is better for insulin levels and blood sugar than a frozen dessert with no fiber and sugars. That makes sense. I mean, if you're going to eat, if you're going to say that 2 cups of mango a day is going to, because that's, it's easy to study one fruit. It's not as easy to study, let's eat a variety of fruits and see what goes on. So you don't necessarily have to eat 2 cups of fresh mango. You can eat fruit that's local and available here. So, for example, if you eat a cup of blueberries, you can improve your endothelial function. That's the lining of the inside of your blood vessels. If you eat an ounce and a half of walnuts a day, it can be good for your gut health. If you eat 16 almonds before every meal, it can help improve your blood sugars. If you eat pistachios 3 times a day, it can lower your, 3 times a week, sorry, you can lower your risk of dying. While eating 1 to 3 ounces a day can improve heart health. So you know what? These are nice findings, but I can't stand it when it says eat. I agree with her. You don't have to like think about, I must eat this amount of this healthy food. I have to measure it out and eat that amount of healthy food, and that's going to make me healthier. It's a good idea to have these foods around and then eat a reasonable amount of them most days. So, I mean, for me, for example, I buy fresh berries every week. I have some combination of raspberries, blueberries, strawberries, blackberries. Sometimes I have, I usually have 3 of them. Sometimes I have 4 of them, but usually I have 3 of them. And I will, it's the strawberries that I'll interchange because the strawberries are coming from far away right now. And the strawberries have to look good for me to grab them. So it's, I like to get the blackberries and the blueberries because they're very, I prioritize them because they're very dark. And what is good about dark fruits and vegetables? The anthocyanins, which are wonderful antioxidants. So I prioritize them, but you're still going to get, so you get anthocyanins in blueberries and blackberries, and you get ellagic acid in raspberries and strawberries, which an ellagic acid is very good for you. You also get ellagic acid in pomegranate. So if you drink pomegranate juice, and how much pomegranate juice should you drink every day? You know what? Do somewhere between 2 and 8 ounces of pomegranate juice a day, and that's going to make a change in your health. Do you want to have pomegranate juice every day? Not necessarily. So have some pomegranate juice in the house. And sip off it every couple of days, and it'll make a difference. If you do that, plus the blueberries, plus the raspberries, plus the strawberries, and you mix and match on various days, you're going to be doing better with your health. So they're all great foods, and you're not necessarily going to eat them daily. But dosing foods is a pain in the butt, and I don't necessarily recommend it because there's too much thought process around it. If you did all of the science-backed dose-dependent foods, if you add up the calories of all of those foods the research suggests, you won't be able to eat very much else. So that's why, and you can eat nuts unless you hate them or are allergic to them, and fruits and vegetables. The groups of foods are nutritious and support good gut health. And if you eat it at a particular frequency, it's going to be helpful, but I think you shouldn't stress about it. I think it's a good idea to have healthy foods in the house and make reasonable meals with them that are good for your appetite and your hunger and that make sense with that, whatever else you're eating. But you don't have to like measure out, I have to eat so many blueberries or so many blackberries a day in order to, well, what I do is like, so one of my favorite things is I bring to work, because I have my breakfast after I get to work on a break, and I bring overnight oats. Sometimes I make the overnight oats. You can also, there's a couple of brands of overnight oats that you can buy that have very clean ingredients. So to make things easier, I will purchase those. And what I like to do is I make a little parfait, which means I'll get 2 flavors of whatever brand of overnight oats I have. So for example, I have vanilla and chocolate, and I'll get a container. I'll put half of the chocolate container on the bottom. Then I'll put in a layer of chia seeds, and then I put a half of the container of vanilla on top. And I leave it like that. And then a day or two before I'm going to bring it to work, I will cut up the fruit and I'll put up my berries on top of it. So I found that like putting it on too many days in advance, the berries go bad. So I put it on 1 to 2 days in advance. And then I put it in the fridge at work and then it's ready for me. And so now I have this overnight oats, and it's covered in 1/3 a third of the top is covered in blueberries, and then blackberries, and then either strawberries or raspberries, sometimes both. And so that's what I take out of the fridge when I'm ready to eat. And then I have some healthy granola. So I have there's a family that makes granola that we can buy at our local farmer's market. And the only grain in it isn't even a grain. It's a pseudo grain, and it's quinoa. So it's quinoa granola, and it has pumpkin seeds in it, and it's stuck together. It's sweetened with a little bit. It's either honey or maple syrup and maybe some oil. I'm not sure. Some cinnamon, and that's it. And so it's very clean granola. I do that. And there's also a very clean health food store brand of granola that I use that's gluten and dairy free. And I just sprinkle a little bit of that on top for crunch. And that's breakfast. And that it makes a great breakfast for me. So that's how I get my berries in. I get my oats in. I get the fiber, the beta-glucans from the oats, which are going to count as a soluble fiber for me, which is going to give me good digestion. It's going to be a great prebiotic for me, and it's going to help to sweep out some cholesterol and keep my blood sugar even. And it's yummy, you know, so it's really nice. And you can get the... You can purchase these pre-made overnight oats if you want to, and you can also do your own overnight oats. And you can do, you know, you can get instant oats, or you can get rolled oats, and you can put whatever milk you want to have on top of it, whether it's some real milk if you tolerate it, or a dairy substitute. And I prefer dairy substitutes. My body tends to work better without dairy, although I will do a little bit sometimes. And you pour the milk over it and let it sit overnight, and then it'll get mushy, and you don't have to cook the oats in order for that to do that. It'll soak up the milk, and then you'll have nice soft oats with all your stuff in it. And it's really good. And you know, if you're going to make your own overnight oats, you can throw different nuts or seeds into it, like walnuts or pecans, I like to make the parfait where I have a layer of chia seeds. You can also stir the chia seeds right in. You can throw in flax seeds or hemp seeds. You can do mix and match, and just make sure you don't get into a calorie situation. I don't want to get into a situation where it's so much that I'm actually stuffed. You have to watch out for that. That fiber is very filling, and so it's a great way to go. I tried putting protein powder in it, but the protein powder sucked up all the moisture, and then I got this very dry oat, so I stopped doing the protein powder. But I also, if I'm lazy, I will put in, instead of using oats, I'll use a prepared muesli that you can buy, you know, a nice gluten-free prepared muesli. There are a couple of brands of those on the market, and I will overnight those. And that's easy because you don't have to add any. It has a little bit of sweetener in it, and it's got other dried fruit in it. And I still put the fresh fruit on top and the little, you know, a little sprinkle of the granola for crunch. And it's great breakfast if you want that kind of a breakfast. Now, some people would prefer to have a proteiny breakfast that includes eggs or sausage or both. Or maybe they would like another breakfast that you can have. If you want something carby, is a root vegetable. So you could have like a sweet potato. You can make sweet potato avocado toast. I was looking at some of the Pegan recipes from Mark Hyman, and that's one of them. So it's sweet potato avocado toast. So you make slices of sweet potato. You bake the sweet potato, and then once it's baked, you can slice it, and you can throw it in the toaster to make it a little bit harder. And then you take it out, and you can put avocado on top of it, and then whatever else you like on your avocado. So if you want to put some kind of a savory seasoning on top, or throw some tomatoes, or even salsa, I should bake some avocados and make avocado bread, not bake some avocados, oh gosh, I didn't mean that, bake some sweet potatoes and make sweet potato toast and put stuff on it. Yeah, so I'm trying to get away from bread and wraps right now, so my lunches are going to be more protein. I'm moving towards Pegan, and maybe I should do another piece on the Pegan diet. That might not be a bad idea. But so Pegan is paleo vegan. So I'm wanting to eat more variety in my lunch. So that's going to be some kind of a protein. It might be turkey breast, throw in some avocado. I do like a little bit of non-dairy cheese in it, and I do throw some of that in. And that can either be slices or sprinkles, since I'm not going to be making a sandwich anymore. And then I'll put in fermented vegetables. So I put in a little bit of organic fermented sauerkraut that I get at the store. I have a turmeric one that I'm using right now. And then I have a wonderful woman at the farmer's market who makes these great relishes, and she makes a delicious beet relish. So I throw the beet relish in. And if I feel like it, I might do a little lettuce and tomato. I might not, because frequently we have salad at dinner, so I might not bother with that. But so it's really lovely, and so there's really some creative things that you can do. For example, if you're trying to get a good microbiome, one of the great things to do is to eat fermented vegetables. Do you need to have a plate of sauerkraut every day? I'm gonna say no. One of the things that we've talked about, you know, we've talked about as far as getting your fermented vegetables in, is you can take a forkful or two in a day. One of the things I see is when I get probiotics, when I get a probiotic pill, probiotic pills will often say you need to take two or three of these a day. And I generally don't. Now, this all depends on you, and it depends on what's going on with you, how many pills you're going to take a day, if you're going to take the amount that's written on the bottle or not. But my theory is that if you're eating decently and you take one probiotic pill a day, the whole point of taking the probiotic is that it's supposed to, you're supposed to have seeds of probiotics in there that can then multiply. Why do you need to take two or three pills? So I tend not to. I tend to get my probiotic and I'll take one pill a day. I'm actually taking two different probiotics right now, so I'm taking one pill of each, and that's all I'm going to do. And I tend to cycle through different probiotics. And you can get probiotics now that are interesting. There's a list of bifidobacteria that are supposed to be helpful for fat loss. I don't know that they are. I don't know that I lost a considerable amount of weight when I was taking the bifidobacteria. I think that for fat loss, you still have to reduce your calories, eat really good food, reduce your stress, get exercise, stay away from sugar. And the more you have to do that more, the older you get. And, you know, I've got the stress problem. So, and to an extent, the sweets problem. But anyway, I'm human. What can I say? But I must say I'm an adventurous eater, so I will eat a lot of different things and, you know, try to prioritize really healthy stuff during the day. So as far as fermented foods go, if you take a forkful of or two a day, the prebiotics that are in the vegetables and the probiotics that are on the food, so for example, sauerkraut is high in Lactobacillus brevis, that'll set up in your digestive system and it'll grow. So you don't necessarily have to eat a whole feed of that sauerkraut. Although the sauerkraut, if you like it and it's good and it doesn't give you gas, you can eat more of it. It's not very high in calories and it's got a lot of nutrients. The other thing that sauerkraut has in it, cabbage has in it, is glutamine. So there's glutamine in cabbage, and the glutamine is more accessible when your cabbage is fermented. So fermented cabbage, which is sauerkraut, is really good for you, as is kimchi. Kimchi is Korean style fermented cabbage, and that might be something I might pull and eat some of. Although I think that the kimchi did give me gas. It's pretty intense. But you know, it's a wonderful traditional Korean food, and it's got wonderful healing properties. Again, anytime you eat fermented cabbage, you're going to get glutamine, and glutamine is a healing molecule that's really good. It's the main nutrient for the lining of the digestive system. So if you have glutamine on board and you have any digestive issues, it's going to help you to heal. And, you know, your digestive system is always being impacted by whatever you put into your body. So it's not a bad idea to have some glutamine on board, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in a supplement. You can get it directly from fermented cabbage if you tolerate that. And it's probably in other fermented vegetables, probably available there. When you ferment vegetables, one of the problems with vegetables is we're humans, we are omnivores, we are not herbivores. Generally, animals that are herbivores have cellulase enzyme in their stomachs. They have it in their guts. So that's why they're able to digest vegetable matter so well. We do not have cellulase in our bodies. I shouldn't say we don't have cellulase. We don't make cellulase. We probably have some cellulases that are created by our microbiome. So you know that there are people who can eat a lot of vegetables and have absolutely no problem. People who are vegan. I'm one of those. I can eat a lot of vegetables. Veggies in general don't tend to give me gas. I'm very fortunate that way. There was a long time where I was vegan. I'm not now. But like I said, I'm leaning towards that vegan direction because I don't do so great with dairy. Vegetables, if you're that person who gets a lot of gas from eating a variety of vegetables, and no matter what you try, you get it, it could be that you have a fructan sensitivity, which is when you go on a low FODMAPs diet. So that's one possibility. And the other possibility is your body just doesn't like to set up a microbiome to help you digest those vegetables. The reason why I can eat a lot of vegetable matter and not particularly get gas is because I have a microbiome that helps me, because I'm certainly not making cellulase, but my microbiome is. So if you have the right microbiome and it's happy and lives healthfully in your digestive system, it's gonna break down the cellulose that's in all of your vegetables. And then the nice thing is you can then get inside the cell walls of your vegetable matter, and then you're going to get all the nutrients that are in it. So the thing is, when you eat raw vegetables, you get there's vitamins and enzymes that you get that are harder to get if the vegetables are cooked. On the other hand, when you cook vegetables, you distress the walls of the cells, the cell walls, and you make it easier to chew into those cell walls and get at the vegetables. Get the vegetable nutrients. When you ferment vegetables, same thing. So you're going to be, the fermentation process is going to break down the cell walls, and you're going to have more accessibility. So like if you're eating beet relish, the beet relish has got some fermentation process going on, and you're going to be able to get at the betalins, which are the great part of the beets. The betalins are very nutritious. So beets don't have anthocyanins, and they don't have ellagic acid, but they have betalins, which are the really good antioxidants that are in beets. And then, of course, your pomegranate, your raspberries, and your strawberries have ellagic acid in them. And then your dark purple stuff, like your blueberries and blackberries and huckleberries and black currants, they have anthocyanins in it. Your grapes, they all have anthocyanins, all wonderful antioxidants. So your microbiome is going to help you get to that stuff. So mono eating a food in a dose dependent way, I don't think is necessary. I think it's a good idea to say, oh, it's really good for you to eat pistachios. So go buy some pistachios and then snack on pistachios. Have a little bit of pistachios that fit into your diet calorically, enjoyment wise. Sprinkle a few pistachios on your yummy salad. Or I find that when we get towards dinner, if dinner's not ready and I'm hungry, I like to have a little happy hour. A happy hour was a big thing in my parents' house, and it usually involved alcohol. Well, alcohol happens for me whenever I feel like it, which probably means less than once a month or less every couple of months. So that's why if I feel like having a drink, I get to have one, because it's so rare. And I have a very fine line between between enjoyment and praying to the porcelain goddess. So I don't drink a lot. I don't have a lot of alcohol dehydrogenase to my name. So anyway, so happy hour for me will involve more of a snack than a particular beverage. Now this Saturday, when it's Ron's birthday party, I will probably have a beverage of some kind, but maybe not.
maybe not.
When I go to the Connecticut Naturopathic Physicians Association conference, a summit, they're calling it a summit. I'm going to the summit. When I go there, they're going to have a reception on the Friday night that I'm there, and they're going to make cocktails and mocktails. So maybe I'll have a cocktail. I'll almost certainly have a mocktail that will be enjoyable. Yes, depending on what they're making for me. So anyway, don't stress about eating 2 cups of mango or a cup of blueberries every day, or, you know, half a cup of pistachios every day. Consider purchasing some of those things. Now you found out that it's a healthy food. Just put it in your repertoire and then eat eat vegetables, or sorry, eat meals that incorporate some of these foods. So, so anyway, that got me on a tear about mono eating. All right, what do I want to talk about next? Now, here's something interesting that I learned from one of the websites I follow, and that's that higher healthy carbs are better for menopause, not so much keto and low carb, which has always been interesting to me because I find that if I go too low carb, life isn't fun. I'm exhausted, I'm starving, and I can't climb the hill. So when you do a cardio activity and you do it in an intense way, you need some carbs to fuel your ride. And if you talk to Marissa Axel, who is one of my mentors in terms of the forgotten cyclist, women who are peri and postmenopausal who are still athletes. So I follow her, and that one of the things she talks about is how you need to eat carbohydrates to fuel your ride. And so the keto diet doesn't work for me. Not to say that it doesn't work for some people, because it does. And if you are one of those people that you're on the ketogenic diet and you heard the angels singing and it's fantastic for you, then please continue your ketogenic diet as long as you are healthy. There's some concern that if you eat a ketogenic diet and you're peri-postmenopausal, that you're going to lose bone density. And one of the reasons there is because one of the reasons you do it is because it makes it so much easier to maintain a healthy weight. Well, it breaks down tissue. It makes you, because you're so ready to burn parts of your body for fuel, especially fat, but there must be some level of breaking down of bone tissue. And that is why. And the issue there is that when you are doing a ketogenic diet, some people's bodies find that to be stressful. They feel like they're starving. I mean, whole point is that you go into ketosis, and you're in ketosis. When you're in ketosis, it's sort of like you're starving. So that makes your body turn around and burn itself for fat. So it doesn't always just burn fat. Burn itself for fuel, I should say. It doesn't just burn fat, it may also burn protein. It's going to burn some level of protein, and it's going to burn some level of other tissues, and that includes the collagen in your bones. So you can reduce your bone density because you're going to have less structure to hold up your bones. So anyway, here's what this research says. You want your diet, of course, is going to play a role in managing your menopausal symptoms. So diets that are rich in healthy carbohydrates have been associated with a lower prevalence of hot flashes, especially in Japan and China, where they traditionally eat a lot of rice, vegetables, and other plant-based foods. There was a study in the Menopause Journal demonstrated that greater increases in carbohydrate and fiber consumption were directly associated with reductions in severe hot flashes. So that, to me, suggests, and we'll find out why it actually says, but that to me suggests that getting your carbohydrates too low increases stress, therefore increases cortisol, and part of what makes you, part of what gives you hot flashes is stress. And so when your cortisol is high, you're going to be more likely to get hot flashes. And the less stressed you are, the less hot flashes you get. I know that sometimes if I'm in with a patient and they're very complicated or very emotional, I will pick up on that, and it makes me, emotionally excited, and that will sometimes bring on a hot flash. It doesn't happen all the time. It happens less than it used to. And I have to make sure, and one of the things I have to do when I'm at work, when I'm seeing patients, is I have to keep myself cool. I have to wear clothes that don't let me get overheated, so I can't wear a lot of sweaters. And when the temperature, if the sun is really out, and the temperature gets into at least the high 50s, the window gets cracked, just so I don't overheat. If I'm a little bit on the cold side, everybody's happier. I mean, maybe not people who tend to be cold, but keeping myself a little on the cool side makes it so I'm less likely to get excited, upset, and overheated. You know, all the stuff with the post-vaccine syndrome and the chronic Lyme stuff. That affects your autonomic nervous system, and keeping cool is one of the ways that I keep my vagus nerve working in a happy way. So In this, there was a study where they divided participants into two groups, which was an intervention and a control group. And they, in the control maintained their usual diet. The intervention group minimized oil and fatty foods and increased whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. And they had weekly meetings. So they had a mobile app, and in the mobile app, they were able to track what was going on with them, and they used a scale called the Menopause-Specific Quality of Life Questionnaire, and the results were impressive. Women in the intervention group had an 88% reduction in moderate to severe hot flashes, and it was over 12 weeks, and only 34 in the control group, so there's some placebo effect. By the study's end, half the participants in the intervention group reported being free of moderate to severe hot flashes entirely, in contrast to the control group, where they still had a 34% reduction and that was it. The dietary intervention also led to some weight loss, with participants shedding an average of 7.9 pounds. Not 8, but 7.9. Across various domains of the MenQoL questionnaire, particularly in vasomotor, physical, and sexual health, and the enhancements suggest that the benefits of healthy carbohydrate-rich diets extend beyond symptom relief. It contributed to overall physical and emotional well-being. According to the study, the greater reduction in fat intake and greater the increase in carbs and other fiber consumption, the regular the reduction in severe hot flashes. The quality of the carbohydrates you consume is important for managing menopausal symptoms. So this doesn't mean go eat pastries and sugar and sweets. So they did some research in Iran. So you really have to, in Iran, they showed that the quality of the carbohydrates is really what's important. In this study, there were almost 400 women in the study. They found an inverse relationship between the quality of the carbohydrates and the severity of menopausal symptoms. Women with higher carb quality had fewer total menopause symptoms, including hot flashes, mood swings, and sleep disturbance. And the quality of the carbohydrate intake, not just the quantity, plays an important role in enhancing your menopausal experience. So you want to get nutrient-dense carbohydrates and support your body's hormonal balance, and that'll help reduce the frequency and intensity of uncomfortable symptoms. If you eat too many refined, now this is just shocking, too many refined carbohydrates like sweetened beverages, other ultra-processed foods, leads to depression and have a similar effect during menopause. And that's because processed foods have seed oils that have a lot of polyunsaturated fats like linoleic acid that mimic estrogen, and it contributes to estrogen. So that's one of the ways that polyunsaturated fats work. So if you think all this fuss about seed oils is not something to be concerned about, I don't agree. So having too many polyunsaturated fatty acids is not good for you. So avoiding seed oils is a good thing. So take a look at your mayonnaise. Does the mayonnaise have canola oil in it? Maybe you don't want to be doing that, especially if you're peri or postmenopausal. And if you don't want to make your own mayonnaise at home, you can buy mayonnaise at the store that uses only avocado oil as its oil. I found one, and I was eating it during Passover because you don't eat seeds at all during Passover. So having avocados and less seed oils. Now, I think eating some seeds is not a bad idea, but having seed oils, you have the extruded oils that have been heated, and now they have too much linoleic acid in them. And linoleic acid is inflammatory. It will increase your PGE2 series, which is the inflammatory part of your prostaglandin system and your omega fatty acid system. So when you have a low carbohydrate, high fat diet, it can help with short-term weight loss benefits, but research raises concerns about the impact on bone health, particularly for postmenopausal women. This is what I was just talking about. Study on athletes, this is what I was saying, revealed a short-term ketogenic, low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet and an impaired markers of bone formation and increased markers of bone resorption. Participants in the LCHF study showed elevated levels of C-terminal tallow peptide, CTX, which some of my patients who are being treated for osteoporosis, they get that tested. It's a urine marker for bone breakdown. Also, the N-terminal peptide, that's another thing they can test. There's the CTX and the NTX tests, and also osteocalcin. They'll see increased loss of those things in urine when you're on a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet. So not recommended for long-term, especially when you're peri- and postmenopausal. At our age, we're already at increased risk of osteoporosis. These are relevant findings. Chronic bone resorption without adequate formation leads to decreased bone mineral density, increasing the risk of fractures and osteoporosis. So if you cut carbs through a low-carb diet, it can have unintended consequences on your immune system. The low-carb, high-fat diets can lead to increased levels of IL-6, interleukin-6, and cortisol post-exercise. This is no good. No. IL-6 is a cytokine that's involved in inflammation. So you're going to get, if you lower your carbs too much, you have more inflammation. Who knew? This doesn't mean eat more donuts. It doesn't mean eat more pastries. It means eat more cassava and eat more sweet potato and eat more quinoa and eat more buckwheat and eat a bit of brown rice. I know that, you know, when I go vegan, Mark Hyman is not a big fan of regular rice. He does recommend black rice. Now, black rice is black rice has the highest amount of anthocyanins of all the rices. And wild rice also has a lot of anthocyanins. Wild rice is not a rice. It's not Oryza sativa. It's a different species. So somebody asked me, what's the difference between black rice and wild rice? I said, very good question, because they are both black. But wild rice is not technically rice. It's a different plant. It's still in the cereal grass family, but it is not rice. But it can be used as rice. It's nice to add to pilafs. And I tend to only remember wild rice at Thanksgiving when I make a pilaf. And there's no reason to do that. So I should make a pilaf for us that has wild rice and brown rice and quinoa in it. And it'll be very nice. So what happens is when you lower your carbs too much, when you don't consume enough carbohydrates for an extended period, your body begins to produce glucose from cortisol through a process called gluconeogenesis. That means you're making new glucose, and the way you're making it is by the cortisol. Cortisol is a catabolic hormone. It breaks tissue down. And when you break tissue down, you don't have the tissue anymore. What tissue does it break down? All of it. You will break down fat, but you also break down muscle. And according to this, you're also going to break down bone. So going too low carbohydrate is going to put you into gluconeogenesis, which means your body experiences too low carbohydrates as a stressor.
Wow.
Okay?
Doesn't sound like a good direction to go.
No, but it doesn't mean,
when
again,
goes there.
It doesn't mean eat pastries. It means eat healthy carbs. So cortisol is a part of a group of steroid hormones is known as glucocorticoids. So glucose, of course, refers to sugar, while cortico indicates that it comes from the adrenal cortex. So it's recognized as a stress hormone. It does raise blood sugar levels when glucose is scarce and your liver's glycogen stores are depleted. When you go on a super low carbohydrate diet, what do? You deplete your liver's glycogen stores. And when you don't have enough glycogen, if you expect to climb the hill, expect to climb it very slowly, if at all.
I have that problem now.
I know, but you have a different problem. All right. When your body senses low glucose levels, cortisol triggers the expression of PepsiK enzyme, which initiates gluconeogenesis. But if the cortisol levels remain persistently high because you're not eating enough carbs, you then get inflammation and it weakens your immune system. Remember, it increases IL-6. I didn't know that. That's new to me. I knew that, you know, if you... I wasn't even quite sure what the mechanism was why eating a low-carb diet is a stressor, but it completely makes sense. Your body senses that your blood sugar is too low. So anytime your blood sugar is too low, your body sees that as an emergency. It kicks out more cortisol, and then cortisol does its thing. What does cortisol do? It runs around your body, looks for stuff to break down, to turn into sugar, so you can run away from the bear. That's one of cortisol's big jobs. So high ongoing cortisol, that's chronic persistent stress. The other neat thing that cortisol does is it breaks down stuff to turn it into sugar so you can run away from the bear. And if instead of running away from the bear, you're sitting at a computer screen all day, you're not actually going to burn up that sugar. So your insulin goes, hey, this sugar's too high. How about if I shove it into the cells so you could use it? And your body's like, nope, the cells are all full up. You got to do something else with it. So insulin says, okay, Charlie, I'm going to put it somewhere else. And the insulin then shunts it to your fat cells. Which fat cells? The ones in your belly, hence the meno belly. And it's a lot easier to get the meno belly when you're in perimenopause because we're so much more sensitive to stress. You have a couple reasons why that happens. One of them is the lower estrogen and progesterone because you don't have estrogen and progesterone pushing hormone-sensitive lipase. And hormone-sensitive lipase breaks down fat for you. So when you're not ovulating anymore, you know, we still have a lot of estrogen in our bodies when we're postmenopausal, but it's sitting in our organs. Progesterone, there's only a couple ways to make progesterone. One is to ovulate, and then you have a corpus luteum making it for you, and the other way to make it is by being pregnant. The placenta will make it for you. Yeah, so anyway, so you're much more sensitive to cortisol when you're my age, which is postmenopausal. I don't care. I'm 61 years old. Now you know. So to fuel your body, Ron's turning 70 on Saturday. How exciting is that?
Exciting.
Yeah. So when you wanna fuel your body during peri and postmenopause, you need to maintain a certain carbohydrate threshold. He says like 250 grams a day. That's a lot. I don't think I eat that. I do eat at least 100, but I don't think I do.
Of what?
Carbs.
Carbs?
Yeah. It's a lot of carbs. And again, that's a number. That's a studied number. That may not work for you. I think if you keep it, and the number of carbs you're going to eat is going to depend on how much physical activity that you're getting. If you're not getting a lot of activity, you're not going to do as much. But having these super low-carb diets where you're eating between 20 and 60 grams a day, if you're peri or postmenopausal, it's probably not a good idea. But again, you shouldn't be getting the carbs from chocolate bars or from donuts or from cinnamon twists from the rice fruit farm. We won't talk about that.
Okay, then.
I love the rice fruit farm. It's a fun place to go. Mm. Okay. Anyway, so you have to have a healthy microbiome. Your gut microbiome will help you break down the beneficial fibers in your carbohydrates, like your fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. And many individuals lack an optimal balance of the beneficial microbiome. When the equilibrium is disturbed, consuming these otherwise wholesome foods leads to a disease in your health because harmful bacteria will proliferate, and then you get endotoxins in your bodies. So you have to eat fruits and vegetables all the time to keep that microbiome going. So if you're struggling to digest healthy carbohydrates, you can add pure glucose, also known as dextrose, to your diet for a few weeks. If your digestive system is severely impaired and you find it difficult to consume carbohydrates. So some people who, like, if you haven't been eating fruits and vegetables and you've only been eating refined carbohydrates, you then go to try to have a salad and you blow up like a balloon. And then you might get diagnosed with SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Or another way to do it is, sipping dextrose water that gives you a safe form of carbohydrates that doesn't increase endotoxin production. And then you can gradually reintroduce your mitochondrial function and reintroduce fruits and vegetables. I also, when people are having trouble eating fruits and vegetables, I talk to them about, are they eating any food intolerances? And we try to sort that out. A lot of people don't do well with gluten and dairy. A lot of people don't do well with FODMAPs. And you can get enzymes now. You can get enzymes that have alpha-galactosidase in it, which is going to help you break down general stuff in beans and in vegetables and like that. And you can also now get enzymes if you have a FODMAP problem that has fructan, I think it's called fructan hydrolase, And there's only one product that has that enzyme in it. And if your problem is that you have a FODMAPs issue, you can sprinkle that enzyme on your food and it will help you to digest FODMAPs. And that's another way to go, to do the enzymes. If you have really compromised gut health, you can do the dextrose. And then once you strengthen your gut health, you can incorporate more fruits and vegetables. So you have to gently increase the health of your microbiome. Low estrogen is often thought of as a key feature of menopause and addressed with hormone replacement therapy that includes estrogen. And there's some studies that say maybe you shouldn't do that. And that estrogen is can be both carcinogenic and anti-metabolic. So this researcher that I'm reading, he's not a fan of estrogen replacement. What he says that we have plenty of estrogen in our organs. It's not necessarily to replace estrogen. If you're going to replace hormones, it's better to replace progesterone and DHEA. So that's interesting. So if low estrogen levels, it significantly hampers your mitochondria's ability to produce cellular energy as ATP by relying on aerobic glycolysis, which disrupts your oxidative phosphorylation, which disrupts your, which makes estrogen's carcinogenic effects more intense. So estrogen production typically doesn't decrease with age, suggesting that administering estrogen is not the universal solution for relieving menopausal symptoms. Despite it, it's conventionally used to reduce hot flashes, even though it's problematic. Research shows that it's low progesterone, not estrogen, that's linked with night sweats. And I am more comfortable prescribing progesterone and DHEA, quite honestly. Not as comfortable prescribing estrogen. So there was a study where progesterone supplementation significantly improved night sweats and sleep quality among perimenopausal women, and blocking estrogen and taking DHEA prevents many menopausal symptoms and related conditions. So a lot of people believe they're low in estrogen because of the blood work and actually have high levels in their organs. This is because serum estrogen levels are not representative of the estrogen that's stored in tissues. It can be low and has plasma, but high in tissues. You can also look at prolactin levels. Prolactin is the hormone it's made by your pituitary gland for milk production, but you still have prolactin on board even if you're not lactating. And if you have high prolactin, you might have, if you have normal prolactin, you probably have decent estrogen levels. So there's a lot more, so we're going to pick up on this prolactin levels the next time we are here. Because I think it's time to let you go. So that was very interesting. So we have to pick up at the prolactin level. Meanwhile, I am going to go ahead and let you go. Because it's time. And the next time I talk to you, I will probably have already been to the CNPA summit. So I'll have a lot of information and redux from that. You've been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch-ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores and WHUS.org.